Okay, so again, I'm going to put a link to the presentation, but I will be screen sharing, so not to worry, you will not have to click on the link, just in case you want it for later, that way you'll have it. Okay, so I think thank you everybody for coming. I'm going to be hopefully speaking about advisors and how they make or break a king. This is dedicated by a congregation of Torah in memory of Paul Foreman, Pesach David Ben Avraham Zichrono Livracha. So let's get to it. So advisors make or break a king. So my first question for everybody is what do you think an advisor should do? It's going to have to be interactive, otherwise it'll just be me monologuing. So please feel free to chime in. What do you think an advisor might do?
Advise.
Advise, but what would they advise on? What would they say?
Can you pull it in a little?
They would advise according to their expertise.
Good expertise, very good. Okay, right? Wise advice of the king, wise my expertise. Maybe give some information, even if they're not an expert. But you know, like, hey, I just saw this thing, right? That's what we would hope to see from an advisor. So, and then what would we think the next step is, right? There's an advisor to an important official. What should the next step be afterwards? Right? How would the king or important figure react to your advice? What would you hope would happen? Would you hope they do exactly as you say because they're your puppet? Or would you hope there's like something more going on there?
You should get different opinions and different views, and then take into account what is said, and then make a decision.
Right. Competency. Take all the information, think about it, and the king, after having spoken to all of his many advisors, will have a good answer. That's what we would hope for in a king, right? You got the right? So, but of course, that's only the one that we hope for, right? We hope for that king, but there's two other types of kings, okay, or rulers that we will that we again whether or not they apply it in some McGill story or not, I'll let everybody make their own decision for themselves. But the question is well, should the reaction to all advice be maybe you should follow it blindly, or maybe you should just ignore it and follow your gut because your gut is always right. So we're gonna have to see as to which one of these advices will carry the day. So if you had to pick who is the best advisor you can think of in all of Tanakh, who would you pick? Here, I'll give a hint.
Yitro.
Yitro, okay. Anybody else have a guess?
Mephibosheth?
Mephibosheth, okay. Does the premier does my hint help it or am I very out of touch?
Yosef?
Yes. Yes, very good. All right. So perhaps at least the first example of an excellent advisor is Yosef. So what do I mean by Yosef? So we're gonna be going through a little bit the story of yeah, there's only an excerpt to the story because it's quite long. So just wanna So again, here's the text in front of you. Let's just try and piece out some important parts. So I believe Mark mentioned before, one of the most important things you hope to hear from a king is, right, when he asks for advice, is you hope to have him asking many different people. So as far as the thing of a competent ruler who maybe would hope to emulate, I know it's weird to say we want to follow Paro, but this is a different Paro than the Paro from that we've been speaking about the last couple of weeks. Okay, this was a good Paro. Okay, so how did he rule his kingdom? Right, he was right. So what did he do? Yeah, this is after he had a terrible dream. Woke up in the middle of the night, doesn't know what to do about it. Right, and so what does he do? He gathers all the magicians, all the wise men, and he asks all of them to help him out. And what's the reality? None of them can help. So then he turns to Yosef, right? Yeah, I excerpted the dreams and just interpretation of them for sake of time and brevity. But as we and so but so then right, so Yosef then interprets the dream. Hopefully we're all familiar with how he had the seven sheaves, the seven cows and what they represent, 7 years, famine's coming, be careful. And then Yosef ends with advice. Right, he gives a concrete plan. Right, this is what you expect out of a good advisor, also. Right, mentioned have some degree of expertise. Yosef's in dream interpretation, So he interprets the dream. And not only does he interpret the dream, he even adds on a way you can act on the dream afterwards. So, and then what is Paro's response to this excellent plan laid forth by Yosef? We get some of, you know, have a nice economic plan. I'll hopefully get you out of the slump. You'll survive the famine and the plague or whatever else is going on around you. As long as you have somebody competent at the helm, it'll all work out. So what is Paro's reaction? And what do we think that represents, a good king or a bad king? So how did Paro react to Yosef's, you know, giving him all this information? What's his reaction? We're now in verse 37, right? So what is the reaction of the people and of Paro? Right. So the reaction is the thing was good in the eyes of Paro and in the eyes of all of his servants. So everybody looking at the situation understands what's going on and makes an evaluation that this is the best idea we've ever heard of. This is definitely right. There's no question here. We heard everybody else's. They were all useless. They didn't know what they're talking about. Yosef knows. And then Paro decides. So clearly God is with you. So we're going to let, so therefore we should put you in charge. And so what does Paro promptly do? Again, the reason why we're going through the story so in depth is because the details will be very relevant for when we start going through the Megillah. So what does he do? He placed him over the whole land, and he took off his signet ring from his hand, put it upon Yosef's hand, and arrayed for him in vestures of fine linen, and put a gold chain upon his neck, and made him ride in the chariot which he had, and cried the cry before him of Rafe. And he set him all over all of Egypt. So it's part of, right? So let's break it down into pieces. So first there's a problem, right? Paro has a bad dream, doesn't know what to do with it. Then we see that he seeks advice, as one would expect somebody to, and he asks for a wide range of opinions, and he gets them. He hears a whole bunch of them that are terrible, then he finally hears Yosef's, and it's right, and it sounds great. He goes with the idea, right? And not only that, you know, after he hears the good idea, good advice, he realizes that there must be some divine inspiration as well as divine aid being given to Yosef, and says, therefore, Yosef is worthy of being, you know, my most trusted advisor. I'll give my second ring. And as we see from the rest of the Sefer Bereishit, we see that Yosef actually guides Egypt to unprecedented prosperity, where they are in control basically of the entirety of the area during the famine, and they are, and everybody comes to bow down before them, and things are great. That is what potentially a power could have, having good advisors. If you have a good advisor or good advisors, this is what you would hope for. Massive empire, managed to avoid seemingly a catastrophe that's, you know, an act of God. They get by perfectly fine without a scratch, coming even stronger for it. So this is, again, this is our ideal advisor. This is also, we have our potentially an ideal form of king. We can argue, again, because he is Paro, but again, right, this is a potential ideal form of government. Assuming you have a competent king, competent advisors, things can work out great. So now I want to take us a step towards the Megillah, right? Megillah and Esther. So I'm going to give a list of a whole bunch of different types of advice given to Ahasuerus. We are going to see if we have time to actually look into the stories themselves. For now, I'm going to give you the titles of the stories, and then you'll tell me if it's tell me whether or not the characterization that I gave is correct or not. Okay? So here we go. So the first story we have is of Ahasuerus. After he gets drunk at a party, he asks his wife to come before him, and his wife says no. Okay, so we mentioned before how, you know, Paro asked in his terrible dream that he think might relate to the national security issues. So do we think that this is a case that's worthy of consulting all of your advisors? What do we think? Would you, your wife said, no, I don't want to show up to your party, I have my own party. Would this be would you expect that requiring a convening of your whole tribunal, no, and everybody you know?
No.
No, right? Why are you doing that? No. Okay, so let's keep going.
Private matter.
Right? So that one, we're like, okay, I don't know why, but again, that's the first time we see all of his seven advisors. They come up many times throughout that first story. Super weird. Okay? Then the next one that's going to come up is after he gets rid of his wife, and now he has no wife. So normally, if you happen to have just killed off or banished your wife, you probably should have known that that happened. And also, you would expect the competent king to go get a new wife because he's the king. But that's not what ends up happening. In the end of that story, his servants do it. Not even advisors, servants. Okay, next story. We get to the promotion of Haman. And that we're going to look at in depth again. So we'll leave that as it is. Then there's a sequence of, let's step back. So would you expect there to be a discussion and advisors about should we hire the new premier, the new prime minister? To go to call on the king. Would you expect there to be, you know, a nice long discussion? You hope for there to be one? Probably. There wasn't one. Next, we have a discussion of can I kill off an entire people who I think might be trying to kill us all? And is there, you know, any discussion, any investigation? No, nothing. Just, you know, Haman deciding, you know what, getting free reign to just wipe out all the Jews. Okay? And then when we finally start getting these nice long discussions, the first time we hear an actual common discussion is when he's asking his wife, Queen Esther, what would you like? And, you know, what kind of party should we throw? So again, does Dr. Zverev sound very competent through all these stories so far?
No.
No, right? Not the king we're hoping for. Okay, the next one we have is that he has a bad nightmare and he calls in his advisors. So would you say this is a worthy one? Again, remembering the story with Paro, would you say potentially this is a worthy reason? Right, so again, this one might be, right? But again, we'll look at that. Hopefully we'll have to look at it more inside. Okay, and then the subsequent story of when you're asked what's the proper way to give somebody honor, is that something you expect a king to be asking or know how to do? Would you expect that to be question asked?
I don't know what to do.
Right? A king should know how to honor people, right? That's like basic part of the job, right? You can't throw a party. He's been throwing parties the whole time. He forgot how to honor people. A little strange. So far we have one time that it made sense. And then we have a lot of times where we're not entirely sure why he's asking for advice at this point. Okay. Then again, we have him speaking to his wife at a party, asking his wife what she likes. Again, unclear whether or not that was a good idea while you're asking your wife, long series of advice there. Seems a bit a little strange. Then in the intervening second, we had the downfall of Haman. And we have Carvona saying, oh, by the way, you should hang him. Okay? Therefore, now all of a sudden, we have Ahasuerus listening to good advice. Then at the end of the story, when we try and undo everything, that requires a lot of work and effort. And lastly, the question, again, there's another question to ask to Queen Esther, should we continue the war? Okay, so these are the advices given to Ahasuerus. Yeah, I know I'm running through it. I apologize. We're going to do it in depth. I just want to make sure we had an overall picture first, and then we're going to analyze some of the advisors. See, is he truly are the advisors as incompetent as I presented them? I know I've done fair that I didn't let you see the verses yet. And also, is Ahasuerus truly as incompetent as I portrayed him so far? Okay, so now let's dive in. So the first verses we're not going to read. I'm going to have interest of time. So there's very little to save in terms of Ahasuerus or his advisor's pride. They turn a mere squabble between husband and wife into a matter of national security as well as honor of every man and woman in the country, which is definitely a thing that only makes sense when you're very inebriated after having been drunk for the last 6 months, right? So that is this first story. If somebody else has a better read or an idea to make that sound more positive, feel free to float it now. If not, we'll just assume it was the drunken rambling.
Why would you have to go to sleep there?
Okay. So, okay, right. So the question is, what would you do then, right? So again, so currently same is pretty bad, right? That first one, we'll write it off as it was a drunken escapade, maybe not his fault. We could pretend. Okay, but now let's look at the next one where it starts getting a little, like, again, a king getting drunk in front of all of his advisors and them all having bad ideas at the same time is a problem. For more on that, I'm not allowed to talk about politics. So that's what it seems like from here. Like, really bad decisions. I don't know what happened here. Maybe they're all drunk. That's the best case scenario. Then we move on to the case of what happens when Ahasuerus finally realizes what happened in his when he was drunk, when he accidentally banished or murdered, depending on the interpretation, his wife. Right, so now what happens next? So, yeah, we're now looking for a new queen for the entirety of a large, sprawling empire. So as we started off in the beginning, and Mark was very helpful at pointing out, right, so you hope that the king, when he makes important decisions, he would ask reasonable advice from people who know things, or we'd expect him to be competent in and of by himself. We would hope for one of those two things. But let's see what happens here, right? So finally, Ahasuerus realizes what happens, then in the second verse. So then who's the one that he turns to? Again, we mentioned a whole bunch of advisors earlier, last chapter. But instead, who are the ones who decide who's going to be the new queen? We have the servants. So that's the English translation of JPS. But the Hebrew is na'are, which means like the young men, which is even less qualified. If you thought, right, so it does not sound very positive that they're the ones who were in charge. And as you could have guessed, if you were to have asked a bunch of young men what had the best way to determine the next queen, they decide on a beauty pageant / generous harem consisting of every woman that they could possibly find in the entirety of the empire. Yeah, this sounds like it's out of the fantasies of a teenager, yet this is what's actually going down in the entirety of a theoretically respectable empire. So this is the advice given to him by the young men in his court, right? The term na'ar does not imply an adult. It definitely implies somebody more youthful and childlike. And what is the response of Ahasuerus? His response is, of course, and they did so. So this sounds like a king who's simply doing as he pleases, no idea what's going on. And as far as advice he's getting, he does not seem to be picky whatsoever about who can give advice. Seems pretty bad. And then to make it even more confusing, when we get to the promotion of Haman, so we mentioned how in order before he was promoted to being, you know, the second in command of all of Egypt, he, you know, interpreted Paro's dream, gave a concrete plan, and clearly demonstrated that the hand of God is behind him. Yet, what is Haman's qualifications when he becomes the second in command? Nothing whatsoever. And in case you're wondering, come on, is that he has no qualifications? So, the first thing we hear him doing is, after he had been promoted to the highest office, the first request he makes of the king is to wipe out the Jewish people. We don't have anything saying, oh, you know, he made some great works. No, the first thing he does is, after he gets upset that Mordechai had bowed down to him, he decides, I'm going to try and wipe out all the Jews. And what is Ahasuerus' response? To simply take off his ring and hand it to him, right? His nice ring that signifies all the power in the entirety of the kingdom, simply gives it to him. And what does he get in exchange? Some silver, which he then, of course, you know, hands back and says, use the silver to get done what you need to get done. And that's that. So Haman goes from being an absolute nobody to being the absolute premier, prime minister, having basically all the king's power, despite having no qualifications and with no checks or balances, and the king went out to lunch. So as far as, is Ahasuerus a competent king, the verdict, and are his advisors competent or not, the verdict seemingly so far is no, definitely no. So then the next time we actually see him start asking things that in a way that might sound intelligent is when he's speaking to his wife. When he asks Queen Esther, what would you like? So, and but unfortunately here, as you see what happens, as you hopefully know from the story, is that Esther comes forth, you know, the whole sphere, is she going to die or not going to die? And then what do? So she simply requests for another party, and then Haman and Ahasuerus come to the party, and then it happens again. And then at the party itself, all that happens is that Esther asks for another party again. This is seemingly the first time that Ahasuerus asks for advice. Only the context we have is that of a party. Again, seemingly, no saving grace. Ahasuerus is simply a party animal, and all he can think of and gets answered in is parties, parties, and more parties, and in a ever expanding harem. So not looking so good. But the main focus that I'd like to read through in depth is the question of what happens at when he has his nightmare, right? By Laila who not adash not time at last. On that night he could not the king sleep. So what happens what exactly is this dream of Ahasuerus, and what happens afterwards that causes everything to change? This happens at the halfway point in the Megillah, the beginning of the sixth chapter. It is sung with a different musical note, and the entirety of the flavor of the Megillah is definitely changing now. It goes from seeing seemingly a place of no hope to being being on the up. But yes, we had seen in the previous chapter of Esther's rise, which I'll probably have to summarize outside of how Esther's own development from being simply a pretty face to finally stepping up at the behest of Mordechai. So here we see that again, Ahasuerus is getting up in the middle of the night. And so you think that, oh, what would he do? He would simply say, give me a drink, let me go back to partying. Right? That's what you would expect from what we've seen so far from Ahasuerus. But for whatever the reason, as he wakes up in the middle of the night, Ahasuerus takes a very different tack. And for the rest of the Megillah, Ahasuerus is an entirely different person. So now let's keep reading. Right? Until now, he was an incompetent, drunken buffoon. But let's see what happens in this story. So what does he do the first thing when you wake up? So you'd expect him to ask for more, for wine to go back to sleep. But instead, he commanded to bring the book of records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordechai had told the Bitana and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains, of those that kept the door, who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, what honor dignity has been done to Mordechai for this? And then the king's servants that ministered unto him said, there's nothing done for him. So at this point, I'd like to turn back a little bit and focus a little bit on what could have happened during this dream that led to this realization on behalf of Ahasuerus. So again, hopefully everybody can please unmute. And if everybody has, again, what could have happened in this dream that would have led to this abrupt change?
You felt divine inspiration.
Good. Divine inspiration. He had some sort of prophetic dream similar to what happened to Paro that finally made him realize the gravity of where he is. Until now, he's been enjoying the ride, and now it seems like there's something else involved. Right, that's one option. What's another option? If divine inspiration, what else could have happened in the dream? So another answer, again, related to divine inspiration, but a little narrowing down, is that not that he had necessarily divine inspiration, but he finally saw where his future is headed. he notices that he's been, like, in his dream, that he's been being led by the nose in a drunken stupor, not knowing where tomorrow may lead. Does anybody here has seen the Truman Show? I hope people have. If not, I'm not going to ruin it for you. But basically, so sometimes people live their entire lives not realizing what's going on around them. And sometimes it takes just one moment to shift that entire focus and to change your perspective. And that moment, seemingly, is during this dream sequence. And then when he wakes up, that's when Ahasuerus' entire personality and his whole life turns right around. So now let's see what happens next. The next thing that happens is that Ahasuerus starts acting like a king. Notice until now, the way this has worked is he simply asked for an advisor, then his advisor gave him a wholesale plan, and he just bought hook, line, and sinker and went with it. No thought, nothing else, just did it. But what happens now is that the king, after having the servants having said that he didn't repay a debt to somebody who saved his life, he asks who is in the court. And then Haman was there, and the king's servants said unto him, behold, Haman standeth in the court. So what happens now is that Ahasuerus' mind finally starts turning. He went from being somebody realizing that he had promoted somebody, Haman, who is not fit for the role. He realizes that once I just read about someone trying to kill me, and now one of my top advisors is outside my door in the middle of the night, and as far as I know, I'm a drunken fool, so why on earth is somebody going to bother me in the middle of the night when I know I'm sleeping? So then his brain starts turning. We see when Haman recommends that his reward should be to be made essentially to be king for a day, the response at the very end do even so to Mordecai the Jew that sitteth in the gate of the city all that you have spoken. So when I heard this being laid by Rabbi Yaakov Maidan, he made a very he read in a certain voice, making it very clear. He said, Alta per darman kol shadi debarta. He had a look of both of hate and disgust while reading it, because trying to emote how Ahasuerus felt. That he finally realizes where he was in his life. Until now, he realized he's been being led blind and drunk, and now he realizes where he's been. So again, I'm now just going to quickly try and sum up. Again, so Ahasuerus, again, it very much looks like he is a drunken fool throughout the first half of the Megillah, but here it seems like he potentially has escaped from his cocoon of being an incompetent fool. He goes from simply being somebody led by their thoughts, by the drunken steward, by any advisor. Finally, he seems to take control. Of course, he's also helped by good advisors such as Esther, as well as Mordechai, but we see the shift from the terrible king to being a potentially competent one simply by the shifting, both a slight shift in his own perspective as well as that of his advisors as well. So